Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog, live here on Dave Martell YouTube channel every single Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Before we get started, we're going to knock out our plugs here. If you like The Bog, you support The Bog, you want to help us keep the lights on, go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. And most importantly, you can get the RSS feed to get the audio of every single show that we do so you can listen to in your car, on your commutes, at gym, or at work. If you want to support us another way, make sure to go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and check out some sweet merch over there. We got t-shirts, muscle shirts, artisan chef aprons for the esoteric order of grilled dads. We got onesies for the babies. We got dresses for the ladies. We got hats, backpacks, whatever you can think of, Bog stuff. Shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. If you want to support a friend of ours, make sure you go to facebook.com/ironagejodish and check out some authentic, ancient, Vedic astrology. Everybody that has gotten a reading over there has had their mind completely blown. Me as well. Everybody on the Bog panel. We absolutely love it. Neil John is incredible over there. So go to facebook.com/ironagejodish and check out some authentic ancient Vedic astrology. Give him a like. If you decide to get a reading, tell him Big Dave sent you. And finally, guys, the Bizarrechives is almost here. It's coming. The Bizarrechives, weird tales of monsters, magic, and machines, a compilation of short stories from amateur pulp authors from the United States, Britain, and beyond. Really, really cool stuff. So if you love Robert E. Howard and H.P. Lovecraft and the golden era of pulp fiction, sci-fi, fantasy, and horror, cosmic horror, keep your eyes peeled. We will be announcing it very, very soon. The Bizarrechives, weird tales of monsters, magic, and machines will be available on Amazon. So without further ado, riding with me tonight is my co-host Tristan. Andre's got the night off. And once again, back, we have our boy, founder of the Neurona Society, author of many books, great mind of heathenry, Mr. Mark Pereer. How you doing, sir?
I'm great, man. Great to be on the show again.
Absolutely. So tonight we are going to talk about the nine needs. Mark, what are the nine needs?
So we've been doing so much research on the bloats and like the philosophy behind ritual. I'm putting together a new book on that. It's kind of a ways out, but tons of research, tons of different information that we're getting from different resources, new things like the ONP site and Vigfusson and Cleesby and all that stuff. Like all these different things that we're kind of collecting together as a society is allowing us to understand more and more and more about what our ancestors were doing. And so one of the things that I was recently working on, it was a few months back, but we were looking at all the rune stones and like what the rune stones say. And I basically went through like the entire catalog of all of them. And there's a lot, there's like 5,000 of them or something like that. And most of it's just like, you know, just common stuff, people, you know, raising a stone to their beloved who died or whatever. And, but there are a few of them that actually mention some things that we feel are really important for our study, for what we're looking at in trying to understand bloat, in trying to understand, you know, the concept behind what we're doing when we pray to the gods or when we sacrifice. And we start to see like this balance of everything. And one thing that we do that we know when we're working on stuff is that when it all kind of connects to the grander system of what we're trying to put together for our faith, then we start to realize that we're onto something, you know, like this is something that's connecting to lore, to or the theology and the cosmology and all these different ideas that we've sort of, you know, looked at this grand puzzle of all the things that come together. And we start to see that this can be done also with the bloat. And I was talking to a friend of mine last night about that. And it's like, you know, we all thought for the longest time that like, we just didn't have enough, you know, to really put together and everything that we could put together to reconstruct our ritual or orthopraxy from the ground up. So we kind of just made up a lot of stuff. We thought with the Cinda book, which is the book of ritual we put out, that like we had kind of reached like a pinnacle of it. And so, you know, we put that together and we were just writing stuff down using the verse forms, you know, Galdralag and Gilda Hatter and all that stuff. And then, you know, we kind of got into some debates with people we kind of started looking at things from different perspectives. And I just started doing research like I've never done before. I just dove into everything, looking at every single thing, leaving no stone unturned. And so when we put this book out, you know, we're going to be breaking down every detail from how to build a sacred space, how to make a statue, how to do everything, all of it using only the sources, right? Even when we put the rituals together, we're going to be looking at just the source material, like Eddic passages and stuff like that, to understand this. Now, I don't want to go into, we can go into a million directions here, but basically I want to read these runic passages from these rune stones. All I have, I don't have the names for the rune stones. I have the runic codes is DREM85 and UFV1933 and then UASTI1. These are the codes that they catalog these rune stones with. One of them says, a stone is called Svartr, or black. It stands out in the sea. There lie upon it nine needs. Who shall neither sleep sweetly nor wake warmly until you pray this cure, which I have proclaimed in runic words. Then the other one says, have for yourself three pangs, wolf. Have for yourself nine needs, wolf. Wolf, make use of the healing charm. And then the last one says, I say three thirster, nine needs. Right? So we know that this is an attested concept, an attested idea that there are nine needs that our ancestors saw as part of their religion, as part of something that came from the giants themselves, from the Jotnar, right?
And see, so that's one of the main to the rune stones here as our source, because it's very incontrovertible, black and white, literally chiseled into the rock about what it is and is not. We don't have to mess around with details of whether or not someone was biased or when the source was actually written or not.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important. So what we look at is when we try to understand the concept of need, right? And I don't think that it was just like stuff that you need, you know, I need a house, I need a car, blah, blah, blah. I think it was more of like,
I think it's very based on the poetic expression here. It's very ritualized in its format.
Right. And so what we started looking at was like all of the passages that sort of mentioned like these sorts of things, you know, things that the giants bring. Like I think that the word need they're using for is like calamity, like misfortune, bad things that happen to you, right? And so like when we see it in Skirnismal, we see like, you know, in passage 36, he says, a thirst I risk for you and three staves, Urgi or lust and Aithi or rage and Otla and restlessness. Okay, so he's basically saying, I'm giving you these needs. I'm giving you these calamities, these things that will bring you harm, these afflictions, right? And then, another one in verse 29, he says he's going to bring your topi, which is madness, and opi, which is hysteria, tussle, which is binding, and ultali, which is, again, restlessness, right? So then we looked at the Gylfaginning, where it talks about Hel as Loki's daughter, who we believe is Laken, but that's another story. And goes into, you know, these calamities that she brings, which is freezing, hunger, famine, idleness, laziness, peril, disease, and misfortune. Okay? Now, here's the thing about this. If you start looking at this and you start understanding that there are nine needs, right? And you start seeing that this is an aspect of the giants, then what we're starting to view here is an idea that becomes theological and philosophical for us as a religion. And it's super important because this becomes something that connects to the greater, broader spectrum of the faith. Because what you see in the stories constantly, everything, the number one theme that you see in the stories is the battle between the giants and the gods, right? It's number one. Like anybody who knows anything about like Norse mythology in its most basic form understands this simple fact, right? And so when you're looking at that and you understand that, then you have to start to understand that is going to play out in the ritual, in the ceremony, right? Because you're trying to express that religiously, and you want to connect that to what you're doing when you perform Blot. Now, here's the thing. There's a passage in Fjolsvinsmal where they're talking about these we believe it's Minglad is Freya, and that we're talking about Freya's retinue of goddesses, and it says that they're goddesses. And in Fjolsvinsmal 40, it says, Bjarga, wisdom given to those men who bloat to them at the stall holy stead, so high a danger cannot face the sons of men, they remove each from needs. All right? So this word Bjarga is very important because we believe that this is the juxtaposition. This is the contrast. You have the Nauðum, or needs, of the giants, and then the Bjargum of the gods. That's what you're praying for. That's what you're trying to achieve. You achieve the Bjargum of the gods, the helps from the gods, and that is what each bloat is about. So to give an example of this, right, and there's a passage in Saxo's Gesta Danorum, book one, that's really significant for this, and it's something that we have to consider. If we looked at like all the etymologies and all the different things that's being described here, then you could start to really see that it comes together with this. So in this, Hadding, he kills a god, right? That's what we're told, that he kills a god. Rydberg broke this down and showed that Hadding is, you know, basically fighting with his old nemesis, Oether Spitdagger, and that Freya is his wife, and that she basically comes forth after Hadding does this and places this curse on him. Now, I'm going to read this curse because it's very important to what we're looking at. She says, "Whether you tread the fields afoot or spread canvas overseas, you shall suffer the hate of the gods, and through all the world shall behold the elements oppose your purposes. A field you shall fall, on sea you shall be tossed, an eternal tempest shall attend the steps of your wandering, nor shall frostbind ever quit your sails, nor shall your roof tree roof you. But if you seek it, it shall fall smitten by the hurricane. Your herd shall perish a bitter chill." Okay? And it goes on and tells him he'll be a pestilent tetter and all this stuff. And it basically mimics a lot of what we see in Skirnir's Maul when Skirnir, you know, starts cursing Gerdr. But that's not really important here. So what you're seeing here is everything that she describes, bitter chill, hurricanes, and stuff like that. Those are all things that we can see in the names of giants that they specifically are involved in. The gods don't bring hurricanes, Jotuns do. They don't bring bitter chill or frostbind, the Jotunar do, right? So this is something that they do, and what she's basically saying here is that by committing this act, which we don't necessarily believe it's Nid because he's allowed to propitiate for it, but he's done something wrong. He has to make up for it. It's like a were-guild concept, right? And so she basically says, you know, we're pulling away from you. Like, we're not protecting you anymore. You've just lost the Bjarga. You've lost the shield of the gods. And we're pulling this away, and now all of these forces, the elemental forces of the Jotnar, are coming for you. And that's what happens. You know, he goes back and, you know, his ship sinks and his fleet is destroyed in a great tempest. He goes into a house and it falls on his head and all this stuff, right? Now, here's the most important part of this. He says, there was no cure for his trouble before he atoned by sacrifice for his crime and was able to return into favor with the gods. For in order to appease the deities, he sacrificed dusky victims to the god Freyr. This manner of propitiation by sacrifice he repeated as an annual feast and left posterity to follow. This rite the Swedes call Froblod, or Frey's bloat, which is a part of the Winter Nights we see in other sources. Okay? So we have this idea that what you're talking about here is that you have these nine needs, these things that the giants bring, you know, the misfortune, the pestilence, the famines, and all this stuff, right? And these are the things that they are always described as doing, and this is something that you are praying to and sacrificing to the gods to keep from happening to you. And this is specifically what this is stating. Now, the thing about that is that what this does, and this is the thing I always like about when we come up with things like this, when we start seeing the puzzle come together, this starts making everything work. Because when you look at the descriptions of a lot of the bloats, not all of them, a lot of them, you can see that it states specifically that they are for something, right? That you're not just performing a bloat just because it's fun to perform bloats, right? It says, like, the Sonar bloat, all right? The word Son means to atone, so it's a bloat for atonement. The Sigur bloat is for victory. Then you have, like, Frey's bloat, which is for Frid, or harvest and peace, okay? So we see these bloats that are performed. All the bloat is for healing. And then you can take those exact things, and then you sort of juxtapose them to what we see these nine needs are, or the giants, the calamities that the giants bring, and you see that's what it is. So, and then when you look at that Fjolsvin's Maul passage, when it says, you know, we perform bloat for the Bjarga, and then that protects us from the Nauðum, you know, then that is precisely clear, directly from the sources, directly from the runestones, exactly why you are performing bloat.
Yeah, I think there's a very interesting thing to go about there, because one of the most popular ideas for why bloat is done is that it's effectively us giving some sort of metaphysical energy to the gods in order to help them combat the Jotuns, which I've always been very skeptical of myself. I don't really endorse or like that point of view. So having the idea that the bloat is done in order for some sort of much more specific material benefit in this case, I think lines up much better with the actual theology of our ancestors, especially if we can literally counterpose it with something that the Jotnar do and which we are trying to prevent them from actually having, like, some, as you say, the Nine, we're effectively replacing vice with virtue.
Exactly. And the thing is that, you know, we see it also like in the Bjargrunnr and Sigdrifamal. You know, it says the Bjargrunnr shall you know if you will help and loose the child from a woman, and on the palms you shall wrist clasp around her joints and pray to the Deesir for aid, right? You're asking for their help. The first rune of Havamal is called Hjelp, which is help. It's Odin saying, I'm here to help you. That's what we're here for. We're here to help. And that's what you pray to us for. And those helps that we see that are specifically described in the sagas, that when they're talking about a bloat, that's what they're saying you're doing this for. A lot of times that just gets overlooked. They're like, well, no, I'm praying to this god or goddess because of this, that, or any reason. It's like, no, it specifically states this is why you're doing this. And so what happens is we go back to the actual cycle itself, okay? And once you have this as a theological perspective, then you go back to the whole idea of even having a religious calendar. Now, this is something that, you know, we've kind of embraced, and a lot of people, I know it's going to take a long time because people have done it a certain way for a long time, right? But this is what the sources are telling us. Now, in Ynglinga Saga, Odin has a law that he states that you will have three festivals during the year, right? And these will be at, you know, the middle of winter, the first day of summer, and the first night of winter nights, right? And those three festivals, those three bloats there, or gatherings that he's talking about, the Vaislas that he's talking about, actually have names that are connected specifically to what is called the Mystery Calendar. And the Mystery Calendar is a calendar system that comes to us directly from our ancestors, from the sources. It's perfectly described, and it's nothing that we have to make up or invent things or add stuff or pull stuff from here, there. It's all right there. There's actually an entire book, even though it's a later text and stuff like that. We know that this is a polytheistic heathen calendar because it originally had 5 days of the week, and those 5 days were named after our gods and goddesses. And then when the Christians came, they kind of connected it to the Julian calendar and added 2 days of the week. And there was actually controversy around that and things like that. And we traced this back to our ancestors worshiping the gods. You know, so this Mystery Calendar is the calendar. And what happens in that calendar is that you have these three major festivals, right? Which are Yule, Sumri, and Winter Nights. Sumri is also called Summerdag, right? And so each festival or Vaisla has three nights to it, and each night has a different bloat. That gives us nine bloats, nine Bjargum, and nine needs. And so once we started looking at that, you start looking at, like, all the bloats that are mentioned in the sources. You don't make up any names. You don't create stuff. You don't invent anything. You look at exactly what the sources are saying, what bloats they give us. And these bloats, from what we see that each festival has a chief god over it, right? And those are the gods that are mentioned in all kinds of sources. Adam of Bremen mentions it, and the Gylfaginning mentions it. And a lot of different sources tell us that these three gods of this cycle are Thor, Odin, and Frey. Right? And so you have each festival has a chief bloat. It's called the Hufud bloat, which means the chief bloat. That chief bloat is dedicated to the god that oversees that festival. The first one is Thor bloat. We believe that Thor bloat was an earlier bloat dedicated to Thor that got kind of changed to this character Thor, which is a fable and all that stuff. And then the second one is Sigur bloat, which is to Odin. Odin is specifically stated to be the god who brings victory. That's who he is. That's what he does.
Right, then, many times in his names, Father of Victory. It's very common.
Right. And even like in the histories, like Adam of Bremen and all that stuff, they talk about that, like, you know, what they each god does, you know. And so you have then you have Frey's Bloat, which he oversees the Winter Nights. Now, the Winter Nights is the best one. It's the most preserved one that we have for us, because like you can see a theme within it that kind of plays itself out, where it's like you have Frey's Bloat. It says specifically that Frey's Bloat happens in Winter Nights. It's also called the Host Bloat, because it happens at Host, which is in the autumn time. And then you have Disa Bloat. Now, Disa Bloat, a lot of people think that Disa Bloat is about the Disa, who are the tutelary spirits and the protecting goddesses or protecting spirits who are ancestresses and all that stuff. But I actually believe that in this case, these Disa are goddesses. The word Dis means a goddess, right? And so when you're praying to that, I actually really honestly believe that these Disa are the goddesses that are being described in Fjolsvindsmal, because it specifically says that they are Disa. And it says that you bloat to them. You know, if you bloat to them at the Stahl Holy Stead, they will remove the needs from you, right? And so if you have this, and then you look at the Sigdrifumal passage, which says Bjargruner, you know, will help loose children from the woman, and you pray to the Disa for aid, you're praying to goddesses. And so it takes on a different meaning, but if we look at that and we see that passage as important for this, then Freya becomes, you know, the head goddess of the Disa Bloat, and that's Frey's sister. And then you have the Alpha Bloat, which is said to happen E Husti, which is in the autumn time during the Winter Nights, which would be obvious. And then, and that's like for healing, and the Alvar are Frey's proteges. So you see a theme for Frey during that time. And the interesting thing about it is also looking at in processions, which we call the Wraith, like each one of these festivals has a description of a procession that's connected to each one of these. And so this is probably the closest we could ever get to understanding the original festival calendar system of our ancestors. And it's backed by literally just tons of sources, and we're just piling them up.
Yeah. I really see what you mean here about how the Winter Nights has a very, very connected theme to it. That is very easy to follow. There's a read through everything. And it is almost entirely complete from what it seems like. Though it also gives us a very base format to use for all the other bloats, assuming that they follow basically the same pattern.
Right. Well, we do have a one source, and forgive me, I don't remember which one it is, but that says that Yule is three nights long. And Yule's an interesting one. Yule's a really cool one, because I've been doing a lot of research on it as well. And I really do believe that Yule is was developed because of a certain event that happens on this island. Adam of Bremen calls it Helgeland, right? But it's basically like you have this period of darkness that happens, and it's like a period of like 13 days or something like that that happens, and it goes pitch black on this island. And then at midsummer, it does the same exact thing with the daytime. And so they saw that as like magical or whatever, and Adam of Bremen is kind of poking fun of him for that. But he's like, but then like if you go back, you'll see like, you know, some other guys were writing about this, and they call it Thule or whatever, you know, Thule, which a lot of people know. And this research goes way back, you know, and I don't remember all the names and all this stuff, but they're really like going into the idea that there was a sacred island that people went and performed sacrifices at. And this island had like this period of darkness and this period of light. And I think that's where we get like the whole like 13 nights of Yule. Passages call Yule like Thritandi or the 13th night or whatever. And so the thing about it, the mystery calendar doesn't put these things at the like the winter solstice or any stuff like that. It's like Yule takes place in January, and Sommerdag takes place in April, and then Winter Nights takes place in October. And then it, you know, and the one anomaly, and I will state this, is that Midsummer is not in this calendar, but we do see passages like in Heimskringla that says that a Midsummer was practiced. So that would put like a bloat in like every 3 months, or a festival every 3 months.
At least on the basis of Midsummer, it's very easy to figure out when it is, because it's literally the middle of summer. It's self-explanatory there.
Right. And it's like, and we just don't have those bloats, and we don't have that. And it's not in Odin's law, you know, that these three festivals must take place. You know, and so I would never tell anybody don't practice Midsummer, because it's in the sources, you know, it's there. It's just not part of this system.
So I got a couple questions for you. All right. You mentioned about the Yule being on the 13th night. As you're well aware, there's kind of a debate going on about the authenticity of the 12 nights of Yule. And there are a few contingencies that argue very strongly that the idea that 12 nights of Yule, or as you're saying, 13 nights of Yule, is a Christian injection. But you are actually arguing that it was correct all along, maybe not how they thought it was, but that 12 or 13, you know, Yule being the 13th night of the holiday is indeed authentic.
Well, the thing about it is that I don't know, like, if like the 12 nights of Yule type thing is like an authentic festival type deal. What I believe is that, cause, and this is the problem with it, and people wonder why that anomaly exists and all that stuff. It's because Yule doesn't take place on the winter solstice, but around that time, it does seem that this is when that period of darkness begins. And so it's literally like that period of darkness was like a bad time. You know, it was not a good time. And so when you're seeing like in Grimm, when he goes into like the later medieval traditions and stuff like that, people are trying to chase out like demons and bad stuff. And you have like the Posterly tradition where they chase the little doll out and all that stuff. Like that's what they're trying to do. When you see it in Havamal, where, you know, Odin chases away the Tunrither, or you hear about the later traditions of like the Asgard's ride and stuff like that. Like this period of darkness was something that was terrifying because it literally, like, you wouldn't see the sun. It just goes away. Now today, you know, we kind of say that as blasé, but like, you know, when you don't have electricity and stuff like that, and it just goes pitch black, like it could be a problem, you know?
I think secular society has given people a very demythicized view of the world and the events like the sun just seemingly going away. Our ancestors would have interpreted this as a horrific cosmological event.
Right, exactly. And so like what Yule was, is Yule was literally the return of the sun. And like Bede actually tells us that, you know, when he talks about the calendar system in there, a lot of people talk about the lunisolar calendar or whatever, but like that calendar, he actually says that Yule is the time of when the sun returns, because that's what it is. It's like, there's that period of darkness that would happen, and then the sun would come back, and they'd have this big, huge festival. And that's how they calculate it. And that was Yule.
Yeah.
And so it was with the 3-night festival because of that.
It, with the sun like vanishing, you gotta remember, like, we don't think about it it's kind of hard for us to put ourselves in their shoes. You know, this was, first of all, this is a different time period. They were living in a different area. A lot of these people were in the Arctic Circle. You mentioned Helgoland, which was believed to be an island up in the Arctic Circle, right? So for these people who, you know, might have had candles, maybe had oil lamps, living for 12 days with zero sunlight under candlelight is enough to make you go nuts. Can you imagine, like, darkness? Like, that? You ever see that movie? What's that with the guy with
30 Days of Night?
No. It's a vampire movie. What's the other one with the guy that played Triple X?
Vin Diesel.
Vin Diesel. Pitch black.
Yeah.
Like, imagine that. Like, you're in pitch blackness for 2 weeks almost. That's enough to make you go nuts. Now, another question I had, and then I want to go to the chat. Ostara. What happened to Ostara?
Well, Ostara is a festival that is mentioned only by Bede, right? And, you know, Bede was like, the thing is about it is that different tribes probably had different calendars. But the problem that I have with the idea of this is that the different calendars don't really tell us anything about what a bloat is, okay? So when you're looking at, like, what Bede says and what the Anglo-Saxons were doing and all this stuff, there's no descriptions of bloat. There's no descriptions of anything that actually tells us, like, this is why we do this or what's happening, okay? So it's great to look at that stuff, and I do believe that there was probably a lunisolar calendar on mainland Scandinavia and in the Saxon regions, all right? But we don't have that calendar. We can kind of piece it together and look at that, but this calendar existed. And it was real, and we can actually delineate it and break it down and show that this was the polytheistic calendar, you know. And like some people will make the argument, oh well, you know, it was connected to the Julian calendar. That means it's Christian. It's like, no, it was later converted into the Julian calendar because it was their calendar. And so, and then like the thing about this is that if we're going to look at, like, you know, purity of sources or whatever, and I know a lot of people like really try to accentuate like the differences between tribes, the Saxons did this, the Norse did this, blah, 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 blah. But it's like, if you're going to have a calendar system and then incorporate bloat into it, right, then you have to, you're going to have to borrow from the Icelanders no matter what. Like, pretty much no matter what you do, you're going to have to borrow from the Icelanders, you know.
Well,
like, that's just going to happen, you know.
They say, you know, the Julian calendar is Christian and all that. Well, number one with this argument, a calendar, for the most part, is technology. It's a way to measure cosmological events and seasons and stuff like that. Spiritual things and festivals and holy days are attributed to this, but calendars can change because the stars change, you know, because Earth's position in the universe changes. You know, you have to come up with you know, calendars is technology. Second, the idea of the Julian calendar being Christian, wasn't the Julian calendar invented by Julius Caesar?
Right, exactly.
Who was not a Christian?
But even then, even if you just see it like, well, it's a foreign calendar and it's not part of this, like, we actually have the evidence and we know that this was before then, you know, and it got converted into the Julian calendar and I think later into the Gregorian calendar. I'm not sure about that, but I think so. And then so those dates got transposed into that, but we actually have the earlier dates and we have like the times when these things happened and how they calculated things. They actually had the calculation system and they used the days of the week, and they didn't. The one thing about it is that, like, unless it was a festival, they didn't take days off. And that was the controversy I was talking about earlier. Was that, you know, they had a caste system, they had thralls, and like the thralls worked and they got to eat. And so I have to find the source, because I read this in a secondary source, but I have to find a primary source for it. But they basically said, like, you know, the thralls almost had a rebellion against them because they're like, we're not going to have these days off, you know, like the Saturday, Sunday, or God took a day off thing. We're not doing that because then we don't get to eat. And so what's the deal with that?
Oh, I actually didn't know the source for that. I think you're talking about the saga of Hakon the Good.
Right. I'd have to see it, but that's what I'm saying. It's like they did that because, like, they were changing their polytheist heathen calendar over to the Christian calendar, where they added these 2 days, and they were like, and these, like, your days off, and they were like, well, we don't want a day off, like, we want to eat, you know.
And yeah, so we've talked about before that amongst our ancestors' ancient lifestyle, it's very much that they probably weren't just working their asses off 24/7 like you would imagine. You know, ancient farmers in a medieval period did often. I mean, they did have thralls, of course, slaves who did most of the heavy manual labor. But even for most of that aside, agriculture is a very seasonal activity. So unless they were either sowing or planting, a lot of these people probably had quite a significant amount of free time. They just didn't need dedicated days off like we do now, because we effectively do work more than our ancient ancestors did.
Yeah. Well, so days off would be detrimental because it's like taking hours away from the work period. Like, they had like a season where they worked, and then you gotta remember in medieval times or even earlier, like, they had, what are you gonna do during the winter months? You sit inside most of the time.
Right, exactly. And the thing about it is that you also have to realize that, you know, these people, they were living in a culture, you know. And so, like, a lot of times for them, being idle meant, like, sitting around making clothes. You know, like, that's not really hard work. We just sit around and make some clothes, you know, and that's what we do. And I think we see that in Rig Stula, where, like, Mother is sitting around just, you know, making something. And, like, that's what she did.
Yeah, it was very common for women to basically spend idle time doing things like knitting or weaving or sewing or something of that sort. Simply because it was very easy and they could talk and hang out and do whatever else they were doing while still doing productive work.
Right. And so, like, we have to look at it from that perspective. And we also have to look at it that, you know, what we're doing here when we're looking at, you know, the calendars and the days of the week and all these different things, is that our ancestors saw themselves as very much connected to the natural world around them. And they lived within, you know, an immanent divinity system. And so that immanent divinity was a part of their daily lives. And that's why I believe that this system is the best system for us to use, not simply because we're trying to reenact bloats or calendars or anything, right? It's because we can prove a theological perspective from this that brings something back, and not only brings it back, but also shows you why our ancestors were so vehement about the Christians coming in and trying to stomp on them, right? Because if you have a belief system where you're performing these festivals and you get these 9 blessings throughout the year, right? And you're like, okay, I performed the sacrifice and the gods give me this blessing. And so far in my life's been pretty good and I like it. And then here comes along this dude and says, no, what you need to do is stop doing all that and start worshiping this god. And like, you don't get those blessings anymore. And
somebody, I mean, that's always been something that through the medieval history, that especially for agricultural practices, people just straight up didn't stop performing whatever ritualized pagan practices they had to get, especially connected with seasons or the food, because the rural farmers literally were just not willing to give that up because they thought they would starve to death.
Exactly. And the bloats tell us that. The Bjarga tells us that, like the one for Thora bloat, which we're told in the what we did basically is we juxtapose Adam of Bremen and his account of Odin, Thor, and Frey, right? And then we compare that to what's said in Ynglinga Saga, and it matches perfectly. It says that Odin is the god of victory, and then it says we perform this bloat for victory, and then it says, you know, Frey is the god of peace and good harvest, and then it says that we perform God for good crops and growth. And it says, I mean, it juxtaposed perfectly. It's almost like they were influenced by the same source or something, right? And so Thor bloat is for good crops, for growth. And Thor is the one who fights away the giants. So like it says that in some cases they, you know, this bloat sacrifices for him or to chase away, you know, pestilence and disease and stuff. Because that's what he does. He fights the giants of disease. And so once you start looking at it from this perspective, it's one of those things that we like to say where it's like, once you see it, you can't unsee it. Mm. You know, you can't see the bloats is just something where you just go there and you perform some actions, you drink from a horn and say, hail the folk 50 times. You know, that's just not what it is.
I think that perspective is very much due to our modern circumstance where at best, large kindreds are maybe like a couple dozen people, right? But for our ancestors, bloats would have been huge communal activities for an entire village. Everyone you know would have been involved, and the blessings gained would have been for literally all of society.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe that's what's going on, why everything's been going to hell over the past couple centuries, is we haven't been getting our Bjargas.
We broke the cycle, you know, and that's like one commenter I read when I was researching stuff. He said it was like casting a yearly spell. And you had to bring in each component to the spell, and that was each festival, each bloat. And so once you finish the year and you've performed all the bloats, then you have the nine blessings, the nine Bjargum, in your life, and then you can get ready to go on to the next year. And that cycle continues. And so it's not just a seasonal cycle where, oh, look, the sun is so pretty. You know, here it's this, that, and the other. It's literally, this season, I need this Bjargum. This season, I need this Bjarga. I need to protect myself from this. And it very well had more than likely was connected to the seasons in that, you know, you see like the Sigur bloat happens in spring. Well, springtime was probably the time when they most often went to war, you know? So martial peace with that, the Goa bloat, you know, it contradicts to the Nals of war. And then you have victory of the Sigur bloat, and that contradicts with the Nals of peril, you know? And these things like, and then you have a Gefjonr bloat in there. And, you know, she brings forth revelation, and then the knowledge of that is concealment. These are things like fears and things that would come during a season of battle and conflict, right? Whereas when you look at the Bjarga and the knowledge of Yule, you see stuff like misfortune, famine, stuff like that, because that's the time when it gets cold and you have no food and you want the gods to bless you with that and bring that to you. And then when you come to Frey's bloat, it's all about fertility and you know, and healing and prosperity and stuff like that. So there are themes to it, and it's the theme of the season, and it connects to these things, and it all comes together. And so like very seriously, like the Nordic Society has been doing a lot of research, a lot of work, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of hours of discussion and research, presenting things from their original sources, breaking down the etymology of words and stuff like that. So that by the time we produce this book, and this book is going to be called the Ivanrunar, because we wanted the very title of the book itself to be connected to the idea of an orthopraxy. Because in Rigsthula, we're basically told that Heimdallr brings us the Ivanrunar and Aldrunar, right? And the Ivanrunar, it basically means runes of eternity and runes of earthly life. And the earthly life, the Ivanrunar, that's the orthopraxy. That's your practice. That's your cycle. of being in this connection to the gods and the cycle of the seasons and everything that you're doing and fighting off the nine needs and keeping the nine Bjargum in your life and all that stuff. So then we have the Aldrunar, which is our lore. You know, that's the runes of the ages is what that is, Aldrunar. And so that's like, if you see, if anybody's read the Ostrueta, you see we broke it down into the six ages, and those ages are actually, some of them are mentioned in the Eddas. So, like, that's what it is. And this is going to be orthodoxy and orthopraxy, and then we're going to have that, and it will be completely, like, you won't be able to argue against it. You're just, the only argument you're going to have is, I'm an animist, and I don't like sorcery.
Yeah,
okay, well, we have a not, we have a lot of them anyway, don't we? They keep pop. They seem to keep popping up.
Yep, they do.
So, Mark, I wanted to ask you. I get a lot of questions about runes. Like, you know, runes are probably the most popular part of heathenry. It's what a lot of people want to talk about, and what I question. And when I get asked a lot, what is the best source on runes? What is a rune? And when it comes to the best source on runes, I just say, you know, look at the Eddas, because there's umpteen gorillions books out there of people claiming to do rune magic and stuff like that. But Mark, you mentioned about the Ivanrunar and the Aldrunar and stuff like that. That doesn't really coincide with what, you know, runes, what the word rune means, which, you know, in modernity we say that a rune is a mystery. What is a rune?
Well, the thing is that a lot of people think that a rune is just like the little symbols that you see and on the rune stones and stuff like that, and those are runes, right? But if you look at like Sigdrifamal and a lot of the different sources, and if anybody wants to see a really, really good book on runes, I'm going to tell you, this is by far the best book I've ever read and ever seen on runes, because these guys go straight to the sources every single time, and I love it when people do that. This book is called Runic Amulets and Magic Objects, and it's written by Mindy McLeod and Bernard Means, right? And I've gone over this book, and it's just fabulous. Like, because they don't, it's no new age nonsense, making it up as you go. These guys literally go to the rune stones, to the sources, to everything that is there, right? And lays it all out for you. And that's stuff that I like. I like when you cite the sources, you give the information, you tell people what it is, because that gives you a litmus, that gives you grounding, right? And so the runes, I believe that the runes, like it says, people say mystery, but I think it's like the word is probably better translated as secret, right? And what they're talking about when they're saying secret is it's something that is like a trade secret. You know, that's probably the best way I could explain it, because when you're looking at all these different descriptions of different types of runes, like healing runes and victory runes and all this different stuff, they're saying that this is the secrets of this specific type of trade. These are the things that we use in order to make this happen.
So it's more like a special knowledge than it is a mystery per se.
Right. Not like hocus pocus. Like, I mean, and there's magic to it, because they there was technology and there were things that they meditated on and there was spirituality involved with it. But there's also practicality to it. I mean, a lot of the runic amulets and things you find is just like people's shopping lists and stuff. You know, they saw practicality in all of this stuff because it was their life. It wasn't, they weren't trying to be edgy and cool. It was just who they were. This was their, it's encompassed every single thing that they did. Their entire existence surrounded it. And so they of course they would have just, you know, mundane objects and stuff like that, but then they'd also have things like we talked about with the nine needs, you know, things that represent theology and faith and lore and stuff like that. And so when we're looking at the Ivanrunar and Aldrunar, like these are the secrets of the faith. And that's why Heimdall specifically gives that to the upper caste and says, here, you have to share this. You know, this is something that we're gonna pass on as the religion of the gods.
So, Mark, Nils Olaf here in the chat is asking, will the book be a complete calendar, or will it be about the calendar? And will appropriate Galdur and practice be ascribed to the holidays?
Yeah. So what we're doing is, you know, we're basically taking a lot of Eddic passage, Galdur that exists, a lot of different things, and we're going to break down the calendar, how it works, and where the festivals are, and what you're going to do, what each Bjarga is, what each Nald is. Like, you'll know all this stuff. We're not going to leave any stone unturned, because I don't want to do this again. You know, I just, like, we did the Cinda book, and, like, after I got the Cinda book done, it was like there was just all this like debate that kept happening, and then people started questioning stuff that we were doing, and then it made me start questioning it, which I like to do. I'm not upset about that at all. But it's like once I started questioning what we were doing, it was time to start really researching this as far as it possibly could be taken. You know, like put everything into it, but the kitchen sink, do it all, like, and then do it more. You know. And so, like, I'm literally going into stuff and, like, you know, just sit there and translate Old Norse passages and looking at sources nobody's looked at before. You know, you go into this ONP, it's called Old Norse Prose website, the best website on the internet. I love this website more than anything else, and I'm a shill for them, even though I don't even know who they are who runs it. I think it's the University of Denmark. But it's literally, you go on this website, ONP, I think it's ONP.com, might be ONP.org or whatever. But you go in there, and it has a little search bar on there, and you type any Old Norse word that exists, and it will tell you every single source where that word is found. And it is the most amazing thing. And like, I've been using this like crazy. I use a lot of sources like this, the Runic Amulets book I was telling you about, Duchelu's, the Viking Age book is really great because he lists all sources. I want to know everything where it comes from. And so that way, when I present the research to you and I present the books to you, then you know where it comes from, and you're not just trusting me and listening to me because I write some stuff that sounds cool. Like, you're like, okay, this is where this comes from. Like, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
All right, we got one more question from Mr. Nils. It says, Mark, do you have any books that you feel need an update or a second edit? Have you discovered things that may need to be added?
Oh, yeah, I think The Nature of Ostriches should be thrown in the trash. I look at it like The Nature of Ostriches was something that, you know, it was just where we were at the time, you know. Mm-hmm. and obviously, like, the Ostriches Edda, there a lot of people have a lot of problems with the Ostriches Edda, and they look at it as like, you know, they find like a detail here and they're like, oh, look at this isn't right and blah blah blah, and they think that that's like something that's gonna completely discredit the work. And that's because a lot of people don't understand what we were trying to do. Now, the purpose of the Ostriches Edda and the Odinus Edda was always that we were trying to show people that our ancestors exemplified their lore through a sacred epic. And that epic is what's sacred, not what I wrote down. It's what is the epic itself is what's sacred. That was their lore. And they had this belief in like an epic chain. And Ryberg breaks this down in vivid detail. And like, that's what we were trying to prove and to show people, like, you know, if you want to build your own epic, build it, because that is what is sacred. Just as long as we agree on like a basic format, a basic framework for it, like, the epic is sacred. And that's why we call ourselves epicists. You know, that's our school of thought, the epic method or the epic school of thought, because we believe that our ancestors had like this chain of lore that they had that was built in a chronology that we can see a glimpse of in Völuspá. And that is the epic, you know. So, but, you know, I would update some of that too. Mainly because, like, I see a lot of the translations in the Ostriches Edda that are translations I've used. Like, I look at stuff that scholars wrote and whatever, and there's just so much bad translations. I mean, I'm honest. I'm just going to tell everybody out here, the only good translation I've seen of the Poetic Edda is on Völuspá.org, and they have, like, a literal translation. Go with the literal translation, and always go with something that you can see the Old Norse with, because these guys change words, and they'll change words that make the entire passage means something completely different, you know. And it's really frustrating for me as a researcher to think that a passage means something and then find out it means something completely different, you know. So that's it. And then obviously, you know, we're talking about the Cinda book. I mean, I guess I'm talking about, like, I'm going to just change them all. Because the research is always growing, you know, and that's what we do. And we want to always present the best information for everybody.
Right. It was never intended to be just a stationary forever kind of book. It's always growing.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I read Nature of Ostriches years ago. When did you publish that? That was like forever ago.
No, it was like the early 2000s, like 2001 maybe.
Oh, man. I think I read that like when I was like fresh out of high school. I graduated in 2005. That was 15 something years. Right. And I thought it was great back then. I know you have there's some stuff in there that was at the time very commonly agreed upon, but now we're like, no way, that doesn't even, that's not true at all.
Well, like the kneeling thing, you know, and I know I've been there and stuff like that, and it's like, you know, at some point, people come and ask me questions all the time, like, how do you do this? What does this mean? Where does this come from? And then one day somebody asked me, like, what are the sources like that state that we don't kneel before the gods? And I was like, well, that's a good question. Let me look. And the problem I had was I didn't find them. They don't exist. It's not real. And that really was very frustrating.
Worse than that, they don't exist. There's a whole bunch of other sources that say the exact opposite.
A whole bunch, like so many. And you're like, why would you present this to people as an authentic tradition when it's not only that it doesn't exist anywhere at all, but it's the exact opposite in so many sources. You know, it's just insane. It's like, why would you do this? You know. And that's when we started investigating, like, people's motivations. We won't go on all that.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, so you guys...
We've gone into it before. I'm sure everyone's familiar with
you
them.
Guys that are coming into the faith, like, over the last few years, are coming in at a really good time, because those of us that have been in it for 10, 15 years plus, even some of the older guys have been in for 20, 30 years. Man, it's... our understanding of faith and praxis and everything is much better now than it was back then. And be thankful that you don't have to relearn everything. You know what I mean?
Right. Because that's just the worst. I mean, but also at the same time, it's a journey, you know? And you're like, we know, like with this next book, I am absolutely 1,000% confident that we're going to be able to rebuild our orthopraxy, and like, it's going to be it. Like, we can build traditions around this that will last for generations and generations and generations, because we're going to know that this is us picking up the pieces. This is us taking back our heritage after it was taken from us, and picking up the pieces exactly where our ancestors left off and moving forward.
Yeah. You know? And I know a lot of this is like getting piled with lore and learning these things. It's pretty daunting. It is. It truly is. But I'm going to tell you guys, that are coming into the faith, that have a good grasp of these things that we're talking about, it's not just what we're talking about, but what the sources and what the gods themselves teach us. It's this. We don't have institutions that properly teach people. We don't have credentialed teachers. We don't have credentialed priesthoods. We don't have these things. So to each and every one of you that do have a grasp of these things, when you put that hammer around your neck, when you kneel before the gods and bloat, and you take on this mantle of ancestral faith, which was yours from the day you were born, you are obligated to teach others the correct way. You are obligated to help them in a way. Because let me tell you, a guy, I first came into it like walking into, I had no idea what I was doing. I knew nobody. I knew nothing. And I had to, like, teach myself and dig through tons of garbage and everything, save the people coming into it that trouble. Because relearning, especially like if you learn something for a long time, to relearn something and to really flip your worldview upside down is not easy for a lot of people. It's not.
And I appreciate that. I do. Because the thing is like, it's really hard for us, you know, to go around telling people, look, we're practicing a traditional religion, but then we have to tell them, okay, all the traditions you've been doing, like, you got to stop. Like, that's
so, guys. I need to interrupt here. We do have 5 minutes on the call here.
Okay. Okay. So we'll close it out. It's always really easy to go over an hour, Mr. Mark's on here. But Mr. Mark, do you have anything to say in closing? We're going to close it out.
Yeah, I just, you know, it's like you said, man. The thing is about this is that when you're practicing this type of religion, we have to expect and we have to recognize that we're still kind of in a state of flux. We're getting way better, right? But we're still in a kind of state of flux. And people who practice this religion need to understand that when you get proven wrong, just accept it, because it's your responsibility. It's like you said, it's your obligation. If you find the right way to do it and you're like, okay, the way I was doing it was wrong. I mean, look at me. I've just said, you know, I'm having to rewrite entire books. I don't like doing that. You know, some of these books take a couple of years to write, but you have to do it the correct way. When you find something that disproves what you were doing, you got to step back and be like, okay, we got to go back to the drawing board here, because it's my responsibility to do that for my kids and the next generation. And it's your responsibility too. And sitting there saying, well, we got this book and I like this book and it's been around since the '70s and we can do this and do that. Like, that's not your obligation. Your obligation is to pick up the pieces from where our ancestors left off and move forward as a religion.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, unfortunately, fellas, we have to cut it off tonight. Mr. Mark, thank you so much for coming on. It's always wonderful to have you on. What a just absolute walking library of knowledge, this guy. Incredible. Incredible.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. I always love coming on here, man.
Absolutely. But we're gonna close it out for this evening, unfortunately, and we will have Marco on again very soon. But like always, guys, if you like the Bog, you support the Bog, make sure you go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50, and most importantly, get RSS feed to get the audio of every single show that we do so you can listen to in your car or on your commutes, at the gym or at work. That is patreon.com/thebog, and certain tiers get a sticker, certain tiers get a mug. There's stuff on there, so go check it out, patreon.com/thebog. If you support us another way, make sure you go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and go check out some sweet merch. We got great merch over there. We got t-shirts, we got hats, we got muscle shirts, we got dresses for the ladies, and we got onesies for the babies. We got artisan chef aprons, all kinds of stuff. So go check it out over there. Shop.spreadshirt.com/blog shop. You want to support one of our friends, make sure you go to facebook.com/IronAgeJodish. I'm telling you, dude, this Jodish stuff is incredible. It really is. You guys can go check out the shows we did with Neil John. It'll blow your mind. I'm not even kidding. So go to facebook.com/IronAgeJodish and give him a like. If you decide to get a reading, tell him Big Dave sent you. Let him know that I sent you over there. And our final plug is the Bizarre Hives, Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic, and Machines. Man, I've been working on this thing for months, me and my team, and it's not just me. There's a whole crew of us that have been working like dogs to bring back the golden era of pulp fiction, fantasy, sci-fi, cosmic horror. So if you like Robert E. Howard and Conan, and you like Cthulhu and H.P. Lovecraft, Clark Ashton Smith, you know, all of that stuff, you know, L. Ron Hubbard, whatever, before the Scientology stuff, because Scientology is weird. We all know that. But Bizarre Archives, Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic, and Machines will be available very, very soon on Amazon. And we are in talks with one of our boys that owns a printing house. So hopefully we'll be able to print it from our guys as well and support folk economy like always. But we are going to raise a horn to our most exalted patrons for helping us keep the lights on, keep the ball going. We raise a horn to their generosity and their friendship. Is our very own Andre and our friend Corey. Hail to them, and hail to each and every one of the Bog Lords and Bog Maidens out there. Much love and many blessings. I'll see you guys next week right here, Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern on the Bog. Hail and blessings to all of you. I'll see you next time.